This week on Making Contact.
That 11th of September of 1973 changed the course of our history.
Before 2001, there was another 9/11. It was September 11th, 1973, when a military coup backed by the United States overthrew the Chilean government and ushered in 17 years of dictatorship.
A terrible killing took place. The prisons were not enough. They created concentration camps from north to south. It was a bloody, bloody coup.
In part one of a two-part series produced by the Freedom Archives, we hear stories from people who were in Chile in 1973 when the army took over, marking the end of one of Latin America's longest democratic traditions and heralding almost two decades of murder, disappearances, repression, and fear. I'm George Lavender, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo.
For the last 30 years, every September 11th has marked an unforgettable day for many Chileans. It was a Tuesday, just like the September 11th now so indelible in our minds. But it happened in 1973. September 11th, 1973.
That 11th of September of 1973 changed the course of our history.
In 24 hours, we had order. The order of a military camp. The non-creative Stark order.
The terror and the torture have a smell. You can smell it, and the sticky smell of blood.
They were words that I had never had in my vocabulary. Exile, torture, disappearances, concentration camps, and they became my vocabulary. It was a bloody, bloody coup.
In that year, Chile was in the midst of a social upheaval. 3 years before, Chileans had elected a socialist as their president. He was Salvador Allende, a physician by profession, a longtime leader of the progressive left. His presidency was cut short by one of the most brutal military coups that Latin America had ever seen, a coup that was unleashed on September 11th, but would fundamentally change life in Chile for the next three decades. Isabel Letelier is a human rights activist, writer, and sculptor. She is the widow of Orlando Letelier, who had been Allende's first ambassador to the U.S. and who, at the time of the military coup, was Minister of Defense. Like many Chileans who were in Santiago that day, she can recall in an instant the most precise details of that September 11th.
So by 5 a.m., the telephone rang. I took the phone, and it was the president calling Orlando. Orlando took the phone. And the president said, Orlando, there are rumors of a coup. I want you to check what's going on. By then, Orlando was the Minister of Defense. And he calls to his office as the Ministry of Defense. It was 5 a.m., and there was somebody there who answered. And Orlando said, who is this? And it was a general. And he didn't ask him the obvious question, what are you doing in my office? But Orlando asked me again, take the phone. And he said, listen to the voice of a traitor.
Ariel Dorfman is a Chilean novelist and essayist who on that day was in Santiago, Chile's capital city.
I woke up that morning to the sound of planes that were flying very low over Santiago and found it strange, but we knew something was amiss. And we put on the radio and there was military music. And we kept on turning the dial until we finally found one of the stations that was transmitting the Democratic government's positions. And that's where we eventually were going to hear the goodbye from Salvador Allende, his last speech.
Isabel Allende, the novelist, is a member of Salvador Allende's family. She was a journalist in Chile at the time of the coup.
We had been hearing the idea in the air that there would be a military coup. Most Chileans didn't know what a military coup was because we didn't remember ever having experienced something like that. And we thought that we were quite different from other countries in Latin America, which we called, with great arrogance, banana republics. We thought that we were the English of Latin America, and that would never happen to us.
By now it's 6:30, and the president said, Orlando, I want you to go as soon as you can to the Minister of Defense to see if we still have anybody that is loyal to us. And I was not going to see Orlando for many, many months. Later on, he told me that he had gone to the Ministry of Defense, the door opened, and he felt the rifles in his back. And he turns around, and one of them is his bodyguard. And he was taken to the basement, and he was stripped of his clothes, and there were many people there, many people, that's what he says, and they were naked.
But as I drove to downtown Santiago from where I lived, I realized that the streets were almost empty. And I thought, well, maybe this is a military coup, but not quite realizing what it was. And so I kept on driving downtown to the house of a friend because I wanted to call my mother-in-law and tell her to pick up the kids who were at school. As I arrived to the house of my friends, I saw her in the street. And she was crying, and she said, there is a military coup, and my husband left very early because he was a teacher. So he had gone down to Santiago to the Instituto Nacional, which is a public school that is 3 blocks away from La Moneda, from the palace. And so I said, I'm going to pick him up. And I found the Professor Arenas, and he was listening to the news, and he was crying. And then suddenly we heard the voice of Allende in his last words.
Le salva el presidente de la República. Desde el Palacio de la Moneda. Informaciones confirmadas señalan que un sector de la marinería habría aislado Valparaíso.
In which he told the people in the famous speech, one day the anchas alamedas, the broad streets, would be open again for the free man to walk. And he asked the people not to go out and try to defend the government because it would be a massacre.
Viva Chile! Viva el pueblo! Vivan los trabajadores! Estas son mis últimas palabras.
Then we heard in the other radios the news that they were going to bomb the palace and urging people to get out of the streets. And Allende said that he was never going to surrender. And so my friend, this professor, and I went to the roof of the building and saw the airplanes coming and then the bombing of the palace.
Tanks and armored cars had surrounded the presidential palace, La Moneda, after Salvador Allende refused to surrender to the armed forces. Allende and his supporters took up arms and fought in defense of the popularly elected government.
Gustavo y Augusto de Patricio, hay una comunicación, una información.
During the coup, radio transmissions between leaders of the uprising were intercepted and recorded. Admiral Patricio Carvajal at the Ministry of Defense informs Generals Augusto Pinochet and Gustavo Lee that the attack on La Moneda has achieved its goal. Allende is dead. Declaring that Allende has committed suicide, he begins a pattern of lies and deception by the junta about what really happened on September 11th.
They say that Allende committed suicide and is dead now.
That 11th of September of 1973 changed the course of our history. In a week, the Congress was closed. The press was eliminated. We couldn't meet with people. We had a curfew. Unions were banned. The people in the previous government were put in prison. And a terrible killing took place. The prisons were not enough. They created concentration camps from north to south. It was a bloody, bloody coup.
Official sources in Chile admitted that over 3,200 Chileans died or disappeared during the military coup and in its aftermath. The true number may have been more. Tens of thousands were imprisoned. Santiago stadiums that had seen the joy of sport and spectacle became notorious torture chambers, where bodies were carted out by the hundreds, and the early morning saw corpses outside the stadium walls of those who had jumped to their deaths rather than face the misery inside. The military unleashed a repression so fierce that it defied analysis. What could Allende's presidency have represented to the Chilean right wing, the armed forces, and their backers in the United States to warrant such a brutal response? Ariel Dorfman, Chilean author and human rights activist.
Chile was trying an experiment which was path-breaking in the history of humanity. What we were trying to do and to prove is that you could make structural changes in social justice and economic justice, and at the same time not only maintain, but deepen the democratic forms of government and participation.
Isabel Allende.
I think that there are many people who would describe the time previous to the coup as creative chaos. It was a time of disorder in which things were emerging from the bottom of the society. An incredible energy, creativity, and it was like a renaissance of all the arts, of politics, of everything. At the same time, it was chaotic.
Mire cómo nos hablan de libertad cuando ya nos pidan en realidad. Mire cómo pejonan.
There was an economic, political, and social crisis. The country was divided in two antagonistic, opposite forces. But there was freedom, excessive freedom, maybe.
The military and the conservatives claimed that to save the country from itself, they had to stop the Allende government and the social experiment it had put into motion. But just 9 months earlier, Salvador Allende, in a speech before the United Nations, warned of the impending attack against his government.
Vengo de Chile.
I come from Chile, a small country, but one where citizens are free to express themselves as they see fit.
Chile, he said, would establish an economic democracy in which its own natural resources would benefit Chileans, beginning with the country's rich copper reserves.
We have nationalized our basic resources. We have done so by a unanimous decision of Congress. We have not confiscated the giant foreign copper mining companies.
At the time, President Allende and others were denouncing a destabilization campaign coordinated and financed with tens of millions of U.S. dollars. A destabilization that was meant to discredit the popular unity government and to destroy its base of support, and to maintain a political environment friendly to the presence of transnational corporations, regardless of the cost. René Castro, who was an artist, a student leader, and teacher at the time of the coup, recalls the optimism of the left in the face of increasing intolerance by conservative political parties and the right-wing media.
We really believe that we can build a better society with a social experiment. Most of the people in Chile believe that. Some people were more reluctant to accept that as an idea, a political idea, but we all saw that. We can change the world and we can become a socialist country and have more equality for everybody. It was key things: work, housing, dignity, health. You asking for those things in the country, you were part of the left, labeled as a communist or socialist.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Up next, as the destabilization campaign in Chile mounted through 1972 into 1973, US officials publicly denied any involvement.
In 1974, then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger testified before the US Congress.
And our concern was not at all with a coup in 1973 about which we knew nothing and with which we had nothing to do, as I testified to in 1973 and as the President reaffirmed.
Investigations by the U.S. Congress would reveal quite a different story as proof of the U.S. complicity and financing of the bloody coup emerged. The Nixon administration financed paramilitary groups, opposition parties, and the press in a campaign to destabilize the economy and the government. The U.S. military armed and advised the conspirators in the Chilean armed forces who would lead the coup against the democratically elected government. Senator Frank Church, in congressional hearings on September 19, 1974, questioned Henry Kissinger.
I would like the Secretary to tell me how we can reconcile this kind of an intervention with the moral law that we're supposed to respect, with treaty law, with international law, or with any law other than the law of the jungle.
All of the matters to which you refer have been approved by the President and briefed to the appropriate committees. This doesn't make them right.
It makes it all the more appalling to me, Mr. Secretary.
Now, what was the threat?
Isabel Letelier.
The nationalization of the copper minings that Allende did anyway. According to Nixon and Kissinger, it was that Cuba was there in the Caribbean and Chile was in the south, and they were going to get together and have this big hamburger with a lot of ketchup.
If Allende should win the election in Chile.
Former U.S. President Richard Nixon speaking in 1977.
And then you have Castro in Cuba. What you will in effect have in Latin America is a red sandwich. And eventually it'll all be red.
Ariel Dorfman.
I think that Chile was a model for the world in some sense. And if we had been successful, this would have been a form of change, profoundly social changes of democratic nature, justice, economic sovereignty, and national liberation.
This problem was the problem that Nixon and Kissinger faced.
René Castro.
Can we allow this to happen? Obviously not. So immediately after Allende was elected, they put a red flag. They said, we can't permit this to happen.
El imperialismo y su crueldad.
Citing the words of Thomas Jefferson, President Salvador Allende warned the United Nations about transnational corporations and their intervention into world political affairs.
Tienen un largo y ominoso historial.
Imperialism and its cruelties have had a long and ominous history in Latin America. We are witnessing a pitched battle between the sovereign states and the giant transnational corporations. We are under external attack by forces which aimed to prevent the inauguration of a freely elected government and have attempted to overthrow it ever since.
The punishment
for Chile was a really particular one from the State Department. We all know that Kissinger was particularly involved in the Chilean case.
Where the age-old antagonism between freedom and tyranny is concerned, we are not neutral.
So it was a clear message. Any attempt to elect a leftist, it will happen something like happened in Chile.
And so I think it was strategically important for them to destroy Allende and destroy him, not in a democratic election, because they could have waited a few years. Instead, they decided to carry out an exemplary, bloody, a very pain-racking form of a repressive society. And then they brought into bearing the shock therapy form, which was the neoliberal form of economic policies in Latin America.
Isabel Allende.
And then in 24 hours, we had order. The order of a military camp. The non-creative, stark order. To give you an example, I would have to think of a wall. A wall that before was painted with the creative murals of the leftist youth. And the next day it was whitewashed with a soldier standing in front. So that is for me the image of the before and after.
El derecho de vivir.
Well, Victor, like so many other people, on the morning of the 11th of September went to his place of work, which was the Technical University. And together with the students and teachers there, he was rounded up, arrested, taken to the Chile Stadium, which is a closed-in boxing stadium.
Joan Jara, a dancer and choreographer, is the widow of Victor Jara, Chile's most prominent singer-composer, whose songs and lyrics were known internationally and memorized by millions of Chileans.
And Victor was singled out. His hands were at one stage beaten and broken. And he was killed with machine gun. His body was then later left in the street in a población. And I found his body in the morgue a week after the coup, just because somebody had recognized him among all the anonymous bodies there. Otherwise, Victor would have been disappeared. And I would never have known really what had happened to him.
Hortensia Allende, Salvador Allende's widow, denouncing the Chilean military junta to a gathering in London's Trafalgar Square in 1973, 2 weeks after the coup.
Hay miles y miles de detenidos.
And the stadiums, now concentration camps, have thousands and thousands of detainees in Santiago and in other cities of the country, where they're tortured and assassinated.
The destruction of civil life in Chile had begun. René Castro.
I didn't know that I was in the list of the people more wanted because I was a member of the Student Federation and I also was teaching and I was a member of the MIR, the Movimiento Izquierda Revolucionario. When somebody called me at the house and they said, René, you know what? You're in the list, so we won't rescue you. It was a friend of mine who later was eliminated and we went to his house. Because he has a safety house, but it wasn't safe because we get arrested, both of us.
It was very hard to fight back. There was no way that one could fight back. As a journalist, there was not one chance of telling anybody what really was going on.
Isabel Allende.
Journalists learned to write in code, and people learned to read in code. So between the lines, you could say a few things, but very little, and you risked your life. At least you risked your freedom. We tried to smuggle information out of the country, especially to Germany. Tried to hide people and then help them cross the border. There was nowhere to go because in Argentina, in Uruguay, in Brazil, they were arresting people and sending them back to Chile.
When I was arrested on the coup d'etat, they took me to the military academy. And I was treated really brutally there. That was my first confrontation with the military power. Then they took me to the Tacna garrison. And I was there for a few hours and I saw this blood on the ground and the sticky smell of, a nasty smell of blood and the terror and the torture have a smell and I can recognize it. And seeing people brutally treated, broken bones without teeth, with our fingernails. That was my first encounter with the terror. Then I went to the stadium, and then the stadium was brutal. Just the amount of people being put in on the locker rooms by the hundreds, then by the thousands. Then people being killed in the stadium, disappeared in the stadium. Witness of that kind of brutality, I think it marked my life forever. I never imagined that would happen in my country. I never. Those military, our own people, brutally treating political opponent. And people think it still is a part of the democratic system. And it was not.
There's a recording of Pinochet's voice
And Pinochet says, you know, what we got to do with Allende is, well, once he's dead, they say, let's just put him in a box and there should be no funeral and we should just hide him.
Ariel Dorfman.
He's trying to turn Allende into the first desaparecido. He's trying to turn him into the first missing person. What he wants to do with Allende is what he's going to be doing afterwards with more than 3,000 people. And that's a large proportion of the dead in Chile. To take those people and put them in graves and not allow their families to ever mourn them in the sense of not know whether they're living or dead.
Throughout the world, people learned of the murders and torture in the Santiago Stadium and in camps throughout Chile, such as the infamous Villa Grimaldi. Chilean officials abroad were questioned increasingly by the press. Walter Heitmann was the Chilean's military ambassador to the U.S.
I would say in Chile is no torture, because if I say there's a little, they would say, there's somewhere there's torture. There's no torture. That somebody abuses his authority, that's possible, and that's out of control. There's as much torture as there's right now in the United States, I would say, because torture's everywhere.
In a radio transmission intercepted during the coup, the leader of the military junta, General Augusto Pinochet, orders summary executions.
Any person found with arms or explosives will be executed immediately.
Though many Chileans died from torture, others survived to tell of their ordeal and bear witness to the extrajudicial executions the junta carried out following the coup.
Torture, evil, cruelty is something that is in every human being. We can all do it given the wrong circumstances.
Isabel Allende.
And it's so hard to accept that, so hard to admit that we could do it too. But once we do, we can fight against it. Once we accept that it is in the society, it's part of the evil of a society, and we have to keep it at bay, keep it controlled, then we can start healing, we can start reconciling, we can start inventing a new Chile. But if we ignored what happened, if we deny it, if we think that it was, just a few cases here and there, some crazy guys that... No, it wasn't. It was a system, an organized system, like the Germans did in Germany, like the fascists did in Italy and in Spain. If you give anyone total power with impunity, these things happen.
The days following the coup turned into weeks. The weeks turned into months, then years. Through the use of force and intimidation, the military junta dismantled Chile's democratic institutions and imposed a rule of fear. The people of Chile endured torture, disappearances, exile, and economic hardship in the wake of the September 11th coup. 17 years would pass before Chile would see its promise of freedom.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to the first part of a two-part documentary produced by the Freedom Archives, with support from the Paul Robeson Foundation. For more information, go to freedomarchives.org. For a CD copy of this program, check out our website, radioproject.org. That's also where you can get podcasts, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.